Distributing the Future, broadcast February 3rd, 2006. Video blogging, emerging telephony, and more from Brazil.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week, Bruce Stewart is full of news and observations from last week's Emerging Telephony Conference. Josh Kinberg talks about video blogging, and we hear more from Brazilian technologist Bruno Souza on open source. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Host your next meeting online with GoToMeeting. Everyone logs on to your meeting during your conference call so they see your computer desktop on their computer screen. It's like meeting in person, but less expensive and time-consuming. With GoToMeeting, you can demo products, present, or train just like you're in the same room. GoToMeeting has a low, flat monthly rate, so meet as often as you want for as long as you need. Try it free today at GoToMeeting.com/DTF. That's GoToMeeting.com/DTF. O'Reilly's Emerging Telephony Conference has ended, but in many ways, the new eTel website has just begun. Site editor Bruce Stewart took some time to talk to us about some of his favorite demos and discussions from the conference. He explains why policy is such a big deal in this space, and he points to the potential for innovation in voice-based and telephone-based applications. Voice over IP, or VoIP, is much easier and inexpensive for the average consumer to use than ever before. With better wireless and broadband coverage and more people connected, we're at a tipping point for VoIP applications. As Bruce explains,
VoIP's been around for quite a while, but it's getting out into more public awareness. Things like companies like Vonage are really bringing internet telephony sort of to the masses in a way. And at the same time, what we're seeing is, as that happens, the alpha geeks that we like to watch at O'Reilly are really beginning to do some pretty neat things in this space. And it's really something in the next year or two where there's going to be all kinds of exciting developments, and the way we use voice can really start changing. One of the points that one of the telco representatives made was that the telcos have really stifled innovation around voice really for the last 100 years. They don't have a track record of innovating. In fact, they've tended to follow their customers. They'll try and do one thing, and the customers will do something else, and they end up following what the customers want. He used WAP as an example, where they thought, well, okay, we'll get web content out to phones using WAP, and the user experience was awful, and customers didn't do it, but customers really like SMS, and it's become a huge part of cell phones. The telco industries, which were heavily regulated, and these large companies haven't really done a good job of innovating, and in a lot of ways, technologies around voice have been stagnant for a long time. And what a lot of people are talking about at this conference, we're right on the cusp of a time where we can start doing new innovative things with voice. Jeff Belafonte from Yahoo, who's in charge of their Messenger and voice product, spoke about how we're going to get away from even thinking about voice as just making a call. Voice is going to integrate with many other things besides another person on the other end of the phone. You might be talking to a mail server or a group of people or a game or a service. The belief is that there's going to be a lot of situations where it's more convenient and it'll be more efficient once the hooks are in place to make this stuff easy to achieve, to just speak what you want to say rather than type it, or, you know, and when you can speak it to a group. And there was a lot of projects and interesting things going on where people are really experimenting with using voice in the way that we've used email, you know, and IM. Some of the benefits you get from that are a stronger connection, you know, more of the emotion can get conveyed that way. And we start solving some of the problems around touchy emails, or, you know, emails getting taken the wrong way. People who don't write things as clearly as they might speak them, or people take things in an email that wasn't there. When you're saying in a voice, you miss a lot of those problems. And when people can communicate as easily as sending an email, and in fact easier because you can just talk, and you might be talking to a device that's hanging around your neck, and you're not even pushing any buttons, you're not even holding anything. You just, you know, and it understands what you're saying enough to make all the connections in place. You want to say, you know, to my research group, hey, have you guys thought about this latest wrinkle? Things can get conveyed in, with more emotion and more accurately. I mean, not everything is voice either. I mean, when we're talking about the internet telephony and the things that can be done with VoIP and IP telephony, you know, it's voice is a neat thing to consider how we can start using it in more nuanced ways. But for instance, a company called Spark Parking is trying to just improve the technology behind urban parking lots, which, you know, if you park in major cities, that can be kind of a pain, and there's always time involved in, you know, getting the ticket or waiting in line at the ticket machine, or, you know, dealing with someone. They've got a system. They have little Wi-Fi sensors on the around to the parking spots, and you just call up with your phone. When you get to the parking space, you dial in their phone number, you punch in the parking spot number you're in, and your credit card number if you've never done it before, or if you've been in the system before, it'll remember that, and you go off on your way. And it knows when your car leaves and sends you a bill and sends you a phone call that tells you how much you were charged. There was a couple of different people talking, and one guy's, you know, showing off a phone here where they've put in electronics where you could flick your phone. It knows what direction it's going in. The combination of GPS and connected to map technology and the built-in gesturing capability, you walk up to a building, you flick your phone at it, and you get back information about what that building is. The tools are getting easier. The services are proliferating. It's definitely a good time, and you don't have to be an Uber geek to start playing around with voice over IP phones and applications. Vonage has made it clear you can, you know, pretty much anybody can become a IP telephony user, and there's nothing a whole, they're not doing much exciting other than providing cheaper phone calls. And one of the common themes that we hear at this conference and in this space in general is cheap phone calls is just the very beginning of what this is all about. I mean, it's really not what it's about. It's a way to kind of expand some of these companies and get things rolling, but there's so much more opportunity beyond cheap phone calls. Asterisk, the most popular open source PBX project, which many people are building very cool apps on top of, that Spark Parking thing I mentioned uses Asterisk, has a new feature using Bluetooth presence. So now that when you have these phones enabled with Bluetooth and you turn this feature on with the Asterisk server, it can tell when you're in the office or not. When you walk out of the office, it can automatically transfer your virtual number from your desk phone to your cell phone. And when you walk back in, it comes back to your office phone. And you've never had to configure or punch, you know, not do anything at all. It just uses the Bluetooth presence to decide where to send those calls. One of the reasons the industry has been growing so rapidly and it has been taking off is because there's been a very hands-off approach to VoIP and internet telephony up to this point. There's a lot of things happening right now in that arena that need to be paid attention to. The CLIA Wiretapping Act, is FCC is trying to extend that to VoIP providers. That would mean putting backdoors into every VoIP network and device, and would have a huge stifling impact on the industry, most likely. David Eisenberg gave a great Dr. Seuss-style talk about net neutrality, which is the idea that as the carriers are trying to find more ways to make money, they're trying to create tiered internet where they can charge more for large providers to get their content to you faster. And a lot of people in this space feel it would be a real mistake to let the carriers charge and decide, you know, whose services make it over the internet faster. It is a complex issue, and I mean, I think they're looking to things like IPTV and things that are going to be more bandwidth intensive. The carriers are looking for ways to, you know, pay for the investment, but they're charging everybody already to be on this network, and when it's not cheap to be a broadband user in this country. And the overall prevailing thought is that they're already getting paid to build those networks, and they just need to keep building them big enough to support the new services as they happen, and it's sort of double-dipping the charge on both ends of that. One of the disturbing aspects of this is the carriers have a long history of lobbying, and I think Brad Templeton said, you know, they've got buildings full of lawyers, and these new startups and garage innovators certainly don't. And so that's sort of what we're talking about is, you know, large entrenched carriers who've been working this system for years and spent a lot of money trying to exert influence and get regulations, things like the CLIA law, getting that added to the VoIP providers. And the small, innovative companies, the startups in this space, can't fight that very well. So we really need to get behind groups like the EFF and the group Jeff Pulver is organizing to combat these regulations.
Bruce Stewart, editor of O'Reilly's Etel site. Before launching that site, Bruce helped us get started with podcasting and helped launch Distributing the Future. You'll find links to the Etel site and to the Etel conference site in our show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future. We do a fair amount of editing for Distributing the Future. For example, we started with a 22-minute interview for Bruce's piece and edited it down to under 7 minutes. Our next guest, Josh Kinberg, struck a chord with me when he described his attitude towards editing. He said, quote, "I capture moments and I share them," end quote. Josh is a developer of the video blog aggregator FireAnt. A new and improved FireAnt can be found at their new URL, fireant.tv/download. We talked to Josh last fall, and video blogging has become much more popular since then. iTunes now supports video blogging, and shows such as Rocket Boom report 1 million viewers a week. As Josh tells us,
video blogging is really starting to come alive. So I'm very active in a video blogging Yahoo group. and we double in size roughly every 2 to 3 months. We have over 1,600 members, and last count in one of the largest video blog directories, there's over 800 video blog feeds out there. That's just of the ones that we know about, and there's probably plenty that we don't know about. When we put out the first version of FireAnt, we had convinced 20 of our friends to create RSS feeds with enclosures and had to explain the whole thing and walk them through it and do it for them. And we, you know, had 20 feeds, and that was at the end of January. And now we're over 800 and a group that's grown and grown and keeps growing every day. I'm kind of ruthless in terms of the aesthetics that I prefer. I do not like to watch anything over 5 minutes. I don't like to listen to anything over 5 minutes. I have a attention cutoff. And that's just me. I happen to think the best stuff, the best video blogs that I pay attention to are generally shorter. They're in the moment. They are well edited, but not in the sense that you can really tell the hand of the editor. It's just the moment that's important. It's I selected this. It doesn't have to have edits and transitions within it. It's the moment that is captured. I don't think typical television formats, I don't think they play well on the internet. I don't think they play well in a video blog format. The things I like about video blogging is that it can be short, it can be additive over time, and it can be collaborative when you see, you know, all these things happening at once through an aggregator. It becomes this distributed cinema. I can make a video blog in under 20 minutes from shooting with my digital camera. I use a digital still camera that also shoots video. So it imports right onto a flash card, and I plug it into my Mac. It goes into iPhoto, drag it into iMovie. I maybe make a couple cuts, maybe not. I don't like to edit a lot, so I'm selective in what I choose and the moments that I choose. I'm selective on the endpoints, and maybe I cut here and there, but I don't really do a lot of editing. I use iMovie. I'm not a video editor. I don't use Final Cut. I'm not a filmmaker, but I capture moments and I share them through my video blog, my weblog. People just need to learn. I think people have this fear that it's hard to make video. I can show you, and it's really easy. So the tools are getting easier. It's not as easy as it could be yet. It's not as easy as it could be to make a podcast. So I think all these tools are getting easier. It's way easier than it was last year or 2 years ago. It's way easier to create a text blog than it was 2 years ago. So all this stuff is getting, you know, orders of magnitude easier. Most people who blog are only read by their friends and family, if that. And sometimes you can really get wrapped up in these people's lives. The first blog I ever read was, I didn't even know it was a blog then. It was somebody's live journal, and it was like 1998. And it was this girl who I didn't know who was at another college, and she was funny. She wrote stuff regularly. I would check her site every day to see if she had posted a new live journal entry, because she had a really interesting, I don't know if it was an interesting life. I don't know what was fiction, what was not, but she was hilarious. And I loved to try and see if she had something new, something funny. And so, I mean, I think a lot of people, their video blogs are almost, I mean, it's still in that early emerging form where people are sort of, well, you know, what's the subject matter? Here's me. And then here's my environment. And here's my reaction to things in the world from my point of view. People are still sort of in that mode. And I think we'll see over time, you know, it'll branch out into different subjects. You know, it'll get outside, a little bit outside of here's me and my point of view, but it'll probably still be here's my relationship to the world around me, the same way blogging is. Podcasting is typically, you know, thought of as personal because, well, most podcasters, they do it in one take and they do it live. Not a lot of podcasters are trying to do This American Life and compose, you know, audio stories with a lot of editing and background music and transitions that, you know, This American Life is like a well-produced show. It's a different kind of show than my morning drive time radio, where it's some people who, you know, fill up air space. A lot of podcasting now, with the exception of some very good interviews and some good conference stuff like on IT Conversations, most of it is people filling airspace. Some video bloggers, they do just turn on the camera and talk to the camera, and then they turn off the camera and it's like one take. I don't find that particularly interesting either. It doesn't get to the heart of that immediacy of my view on the world through my camera that goes with me. And hence, you are now coming with me and viewing the world through what I'm showing you. We've been kind of reluctant to categorize And people's videos don't fall neatly into categories. So it's something we're working on and trying to figure out the best way to help people find stuff, because it is it's an outstanding issue. And I think it's something that we want to solve. The best resource ever is a site called freevlog.org, freevlog.org. It's developed by two friends of mine, Ryan Hodson and Michael Verdi, and Ryan and Jay are also my roommates. You know, all it is here's how you combine all these free tools and services and can produce a video blog for free using things like Our Media and the Internet Archive, free services like FeedBurner and others, and has compression tutorials and other things like that. And it's all done with screencasts, so, you know, videos of the computer desktop that shows you how to do this stuff. And it, you know, you click a video, it pops up a window, and it's really clear and simple tutorials, and that's really helped this grow really fast. I mean, I think there's really a combination of things that's really contributed to the spread of video blogging. And I think one is Our Media and Internet Archive and free hosting and bandwidth for your video. Two is FreeVlog, which is just hands down the best tutorial ever made on the history of the planet Earth. Three, I think, is a tool like FireAnt, which gives people a reason to make this stuff and gives people a stage to consume it all and watch it all in one place. A lot of people ask me, like, well, you know, I can go to these sites too. Why do I need an aggregator? It's a totally different experience when you use an aggregator to watch this stuff. I mean, when people actually do it, they realize the difference. It changes the whole thing. You've got all this stuff downloaded. It's all on your local machine. You can click through it so easily. And it turns this stuff into something that's more cinematic. And it gives it this seamless presentation that I think works really well. We have another site, vlogmap.org, VLOGMAP.org. And it uses the Google Map API, and people add their location onto that map. And so you can see all these little pins, and you click the pins on the map, and it pops up their blog URL and their feed URL. And so you can see how this is spreading globally. We've got a lot of people in Europe, a lot of people in Asia, and we've actually had our first few in Africa. FireAnt is at getfireant.com. Download for free. Mac and PC is available. And and we also like to hear feedback. So if you do download FireAnt, tell us about it and tell us what you think of it. Tell us what you love, what you hate. And we actually respond in person to every request. And when people have feature requests, we do our best to accommodate them and see what we can do. So I think we're pretty good at responding to people and trying to make it clear that there's people behind the software.
Josh Kinberg of FireAnt, recorded on the O'Reilly campus this past fall. We're distributing the future. In last week's show, Bruno Souza explained that there's an appeal to software livre in Brazil. This week, he says that the government officials may not understand the technical details, but they do understand the importance of open source licenses. Companies sometimes take some convincing of how little of their income they derive from software licensing. This is part two of our conversation with Bruno.
Usually politicians don't understand all the technical details of how they can use this freedom, but they do understand that if it gives you freedom, that should be a good thing, right? So I think the hardest part is not actually to convince the government, is actually to convince companies. There's a lot of companies in Brazil that still don't understand that open source is not about not making money. So there is a lot of issues inside companies of people saying that they're just going to, you know, go bankrupt if they open source their code, because then there's nothing for them to sell. Brazil is a country that we do a lot of custom development. So there's not that much companies that actually earn their living selling licenses. So all of them kind of sell the license too, right? But most of the revenue comes from specific development, from styling and configuration for a specific customer, or from even the aggregate service around it, you know, support and expansion and things like that. Most companies, they come to me and say, well, but when somebody buys a license, I already give them the source code. And so I ask, well, how much of your business is based on licensing? Oh, not much. So then they start to understand that the whole thing about open source is actually about growing their user bases and partnering with their customers to create the software that everybody needs. Once the companies come to talk, it's not very hard to show them that open source is a good way. The hard thing is that is the whole confusion that open source is just giving software away. Now, there is some people in the government that are worried about that we should not work with open source because, you know, we could not export software. So there is we do have have been for the last few years giving a big push into exporting software, and so open source could kind of hurt that. But the fact is that most of what Brazil does is actually export knowledge. You know, it's much more in service than exporting software. So there's very few companies that actually earn money selling license again. I think that would be the hard part to explain for politicians, because politicians tend to see software as the same thing as any other good, right? So if I export rice, then I also export software. So I don't give rice away, so I'm not going to give software away. So this is the part that needs some explanation. Most people are looking at free software in a more pragmatic way. You know, that we have to share knowledge, but we also have to involve companies around the idea. And most people just, you know, what they want is the freedom to get the source, to modify it, to redistribute. But I don't think the ideology of everything has to be open source is prevalent. It's important for us to share knowledge, but it's also important that companies participate in this process and that we do understand that there are going to be a mix of open source and non-open source software. If you go talk with a government, and governments are not ideology-based, right? They have to be quite pragmatic in when they do things. So one thing that the government cannot do, for example, is to say to a citizen what he has to use. It's interesting that, for example, we did have a company in Brazil that was building a distribution of Linux. And although I didn't have too much contact with them, it seems that from their behavior, they were thinking that they would be the main vendor for all the government, because they were Brazilian and they had a Linux distribution. And so what actually happened is that a lot of people were worried about being tied in to anyone, right? So the fact is that we have a lot of Linux distribution being used exactly because no one wants to be tied into any single anything. So I think the standards play a very important role in this discussion, because the standards is what allow us to have a standard that everybody can implement, everybody can work with, everybody can offer products around it, but the government does not have to be tied into anyone. And I think that Brazil has been working for a long time with standards. So everything the government does is based on, you know, electricity, radio, TV. So the government does understand the importance of standards in general, and also the importance of standards around open source. So one example I like to say is Serpro, that is the main development company that's a government-owned company. They have like 3,000 developers developing software for the government. On their company charter, they specifically mention that one of their objectives is to create, promote, and defend standards inside the government. So I think that the whole notion of standards is something that we do understand well. Brazil does participate in several standards organizations around the world. And I think that's one thing that's extremely important. So that's why the combination between standards that can be implemented as open source is something that we are looking very careful at. And that's something that's extremely important for us.
Bruno Souza from an interview at EuroOSCON this past fall in Amsterdam. Thanks also to Bruce Stewart and Josh Kinberg. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Online meetings made easy. Try it free at gotomeeting.com/DTF. Thanks to all of you who've emailed or phoned in your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com or phone our listener line at 206-350-0383. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at www.batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.